Here we go. I think this is it. Okay, I'd like to begin with a prayer in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Dear God, we thank you very much for having given to us from the cross your mother as our mother. As all true mothers, she cares about us, but more than just about our physical well-being, she cares about our spiritual well-being. And she intercedes for us at the throne, your throne, at the foot of the cross. She intercedes for all of her children, for us. And we thank you in a special way for her intercession during a time of crisis when Christianity in Europe was threatened at the Battle of Lepanto. We ask for her continued intercession in our personal lives and in the lives of all Christians around the world. We pray, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. So today's lecture is a bit of a historical thing. It is the Battle of Lepanto. Some of you are already familiar with the Battle of Lepanto. Is there anyone here who does already know a little bit about it? So we know, have a couple of people who do. The overall battle was 5 hours. Those of you who've ever been to one of my lectures, promise to try to keep it not as long as the battle itself, okay? So, some of you are nervously laughing. No, it's honestly, it's not going to be 5 hours long. All right. So we're going to talk about the Battle of Lepanto and how Our Lady of Victory saved the West. So let's take a look. I'll draw everything back and we'll look at Europe on the map and North Africa and the Middle East. And I just want to kind of identify where our battlefield is going to be in 1571. We're going to line up the two teams. It's football season, so the line of scrimmage cuts right across the heart of Europe. And you've got, to the northwest, you've got Christian Europe. And here you've got the Ottoman Empire, which is a Muslim empire. The Ottomans were Turkish people who had been converted to Islam. And so they control all of the Middle East and across North Africa. And that's where we're lining this battle up. However, Christian Europe is kind of like the New Orleans Saints this year. They're a little bit divided internally, and they're not playing too well together. And you've got one group of Christians in the north that are no longer Catholic. They are Protestant. You've got another group of Christians right in the heart of France, where in France itself, there is a war of religion going on in 1571 against French Protestants and French Catholics. So they're divided internally even within the country of France. And we're going to be looking at taking this battle right there at Lepanto. That's where Lepanto is. So this is where all the action is going to be focused in on. But we got to get here. We got to figure out, how do we get to this point that Lepanto becomes the focus in 1571? So we're going to walk back a little bit to show how things got to where they are. So we go back to AD 33. In AD 33, Jesus Christ was crucified in Judea. At the time, Judea was a part of this red blob that's there. That's the Roman Empire. So where Jesus would live was part of the Roman Empire. Jesus dies. And he commissions his disciples, in particular the 12 apostles, to go out and spread the good news, the gospel, and to convert people to the salvation of Jesus Christ, the one on the cross. And it was pretty hard at first, because the Roman Empire outlawed Christianity, made it illegal, and not only made it illegal, but made it a capital crime in many instances, and Christians were killed by the thousands. Despite the terrible circumstances that the first Christians found themselves in, through the perseverance, the grace of God given to those early martyrs, and the perseverance, their example won out. And so you go from a ragtag group of disciples who were running for their lives at the very beginning, and by the time we get to 500 AD, Christianity is not only legal, but Christianity has become the religion of the empire. The witness of Christian lives converted the empire. The sword that tried to kill the Christians did not convert the empire. Christian witness converted the empire. And so we get to 500 AD, and all of that you see here is Christianizing. It's not perfect. Not everyone in that blob is Christian, but it's happening in the cities, and it's being spread out into the countryside. And I want to particularly point out North Africa is one of the really strong points of Christianity at this point. We have in, for example, the city of Hippo, one of the greatest, forget about Christians, one of the greatest thinkers that mankind ever produced, Augustine of Hippo, St. Augustine. And so we have, right there in northern Africa, the seeds that were planted of Christianity have begun to grow and to blossom. And this is where we are in 500 AD. But our story takes a turn. And everything that rises must fall, and the Roman Empire begins to split apart. And so we see that we divide the Roman Empire into two different segments. The Eastern Roman Empire continues to go by the name of Roman Empire. But we normally call it by the name of this city right here. That city, Byzantium, gives us the name that we call it by today. They did not call themselves the Byzantine Empire. That comes later that they get called the Byzantine Empire. And it was named after the city of Byzantium, which was renamed to Constantinople, which is going to figure into our story, which is why I want to make sure I'm pointing it out to you so that you'll see where it is. So we've got the Byzantine Empire on one side, the Western Roman Empire, which is rapidly falling apart as Germanic tribes come pouring across the Danube and the Rhine, and they begin to settle all of Western Europe. And as they come across, they're being Christianized. Not perfectly. There are some heresies in there, but they're being Christianized. Meanwhile, to kind of pull out a little bit, to pull the camera out and to look at the wide angle, because we're going to be fighting against the Ottoman Turks, right? So where did the Turks come from? So as we pull out, we see we've got the Byzantine Empire, the Western Roman Empire, Christendom right here. And as we pull out, there are a bunch of Turkish nomadic tribes living out there, people who are living in tents, moving from place to place. That's where the Turks are. And all of this, they're going to get to be here in a couple of slides. 610, we get Muhammad, a camel merchant who trades the deserts of Arabia, going back and forth. And when Muhammad is about 40 years old, Muhammad claims that he is visited by, at first he believes, a jinn. And his wife later convinces him that it wasn't a jinn, but it was an archangel, Gabriel. A jinn, by the way, is an evil spirit. It's where we get the genie in the lantern from. So his first inclination was he was visited by one of these bad spirits out in the desert who was telling him stuff. And his wife was like, no, you need to go listen to that thing. All right. So Eve tells Adam to go get the apple, and his wife tells him to go listen. I don't know, women, what are y'all doing out there? It's a joke. All right, so he goes out and he says, okay, I'm going to listen to it. And we get the archangel Gabriel, he says, is reciting to him. So what the archangel Gabriel is doing is, the archangel Gabriel is reading out of a book that's in heaven. And he's reading to Muhammad all this stuff. Now, Muhammad can't read and write. But the archangel Gabriel tells him, you're going to remember everything that's up there, and you're going to have to go out and you're going to have to tell it to everybody else. The stuff that's in that book in heaven, that's the stuff that's in the Quran, Muhammad says. And the word Quran means recitation, to recite. That's why it's called the Quran. So according to Muhammad, this is the final revelation. There is no more revelation coming because this is the book written in heaven. And he begins to spread the religion of Islam, which means submission. And submission would come for Muhammad either willingly, you're going to hear what Islam teaches and you'll submit to its teachings because they make sense, or you'll submit at the sword. Either way, you will submit. And born right into the batter of the cake of Islam, so to speak, there is at the very beginning an attempt at forced conversion that exists there. Right across the Arabian Peninsula, Muhammad wins battle after battle after battle in the Arabian Peninsula, and more people either willingly because they believe it or because it's the side that's winning or because they don't want to die, convert to Islam. And so Muhammad dies. So when Muhammad dies, we've got right here, this area's basically converted, but it's not done. His successors say we've got to continue spreading, and his successors are called caliphs. And they establish an area of rule that they call a caliphate. That word's back in the news recently. That's what ISIS is doing. ISIS is establishing a caliphate again, and there is the leader of ISIS who is trying to establish himself as the new caliph. So, we begin to get Islam spreading, caliphate is expanding Islam, and in fact, two things that are important here. The Turks come under the influence of Islam, and Christian North Africa is lost. It now becomes Muslim North Africa, which it still is to this day, and Spain is lost. As Berbers, North African Muslims, Moors, Berbers, jump across the Straits of Gibraltar, and they take over Spain. This will figure into our story as well. So we get the spread of Islam happening at this time. Now, they tried to spread, just for those of you who like history, they tried to spread into France. Now, at the time, France was pagan, but the leader of France was sympathetic to Christianity. A guy named Charles Martel, the Hammer was his name, and he stops the Muslim advance into Europe at the Battle of Tours. This is considered one of the seminal military victories in the history of the world, because if the Battle of Tours had gone the opposite way, it would have opened up the heart of Europe to Islam back in the year 740. But it was stopped by Charles Martel with a much smaller fighting force that he defeats Islam, and so it stops Islam in Spain for the moment. Meanwhile, we advance the story a little bit more. We're going to jump forward 300 years, and there is a serious rupture in Christianity. Eastern and Western Christianity developed along different paths, and for reasons that we're not going to get into here, the Christians split. And the Eastern half of Christianity begins to find its center, political center, spiritual center in Constantinople, and the Western half of Christianity continues to remain true to the Pope. And so we get in 1054 what's called the Great Schism, where you get Christianity splitting with basically Catholic Christianity in the West and what we'll call Orthodox Christianity in the East. This is going to weaken the body. Just like any time that there's a wound to your body, you get weakened. If you start lopping off major limbs from your body, you're going to really get weakened. So Christianity is going to find itself becoming more weakened over time. This is when the first group of Turks comes out. The first group. Remember the Turks were hanging out over here, and they've gotten influence. They started off, because they were such good fighters, being the guards of the caliph. They were the caliph's main guys for his army. And it got to be so much, the caliphs, like a lot of Christian kings, got lazy and just wanted to hang out in the castles and the palaces and eat and have fun. Well, the sultans and the caliphs over in Islam did the same thing. And so the Turks, who were very energetic, were able to use their positions of power to basically stage a coup. And they let the caliph kind of pretend he was ruling from Baghdad for a while, and then they said, oh, enough of this stuff, we're really in charge. But they didn't call themselves caliph. They couldn't. So they called themselves sultan. So the Seljuk Turks took over, and they began to spread, and they started harassing this area of Constantinople. So Constantinople is under attack. And they call out to the Pope. They say to the Pope, Pope, you're Christian, we're Christian. A couple of years ago, we were all buddy-buddy. Why don't you come help us? So the Christians of Europe say, you got it. and the knights of France and England and Germany and Spain, although really not too many of them from Spain because they got their own problems there, they say, we're going to go help out, and so they mount an armed pilgrimage. If you go with Father Mitch to the Holy Land, please do not bring your swords. 1,000 years ago, that would have been acceptable as a pilgrim to go armed, and that's what the Crusades were. They were armed pilgrimages. To free the Holy Lands, and on the way, we're going to stop and free Constantinople from the threat of the Turks so that Christians can make their way to where Christ lived, unharassed. That's what the Crusades were all about. On the Crusades, one of the groups of knights that were there that everybody remembers are the Templar Knights, right? Thanks to that stupid Dan Brown novel, we get all the wrong ideas about the Templar Knights. But there were other military orders that were present during the Crusades, and probably even a little bit more important than the Templars were the Knights of the Hospitaller of St. John. In fact, they were there before the Templars were there, and they actually ran a hospital caring for the sick and the pilgrims. And then it turned out where they had to protect them, so they became an armed military order. So we get, this is what they wore. If they went into battle, they wore the red tunic with the white cross. Otherwise, they had the black with the eight-pointed star. That was their order. We're going to come back to them. That's why I'm mentioning it. So, meanwhile, I told you the Spanish didn't really send too many people. And why? Because the Spanish had problems of their own. You'll remember that the Muslims from North Africa, who are called the Moors, if you ever read Othello by Shakespeare, you know that in Othello, he was a Moor. What the heck is a Moor? A Moor is a North African Muslim. And technically, they come from the tribe called the Berber tribes. So these Berbers from North Africa had jumped into Spain, and they had taken over practically all the Iberian Peninsula, except for one kingdom up here called the Kingdom of Asturias. And in 722, in the Kingdom of Asturias, Peyo starts fighting back. And then the Spanish say, let's get it. Let's fight back. And for 700 years, the Spanish fight to take the Iberian Peninsula back from the Muslims. That's a long time. It's called the Reconquista. It did not completely kicking out the last Muslim ruler out of the Iberian Peninsula until 1492. Anything else happened in 1492? And what's today?
Columbus Day.
Woo-hoo. I'm going to talk about Columbus again in a minute. So for 700 years, the Spanish are kicking out all of the Muslim rulers that they could get out of Spain. And the two people who end it all are Ferdinand and Isabella, the king of Aragon and the queen of Castile. All right? They're going to get married, and then that's where Spain comes from today, the marriage of those two people, those two kingdoms. Those Berbers along the coast, there were a problem. Those Berbers become Barbers, Barbary. So the name gets a little bit muddled, and they become Barbary. So we get the Barbary coast. And what were the Barbaries doing? Those Muslims along the North African shore, they were conducting terrible pirate raids. And they would literally wipe out towns of Christians, taking them into slavery by the thousands. They would appear overnight along a coastal town, and they would just collect everybody in the city and disappear with them. It got to the point that along the coast of Spain and France and Italy, entire villages just walked away and went inland. Fishermen were refusing to go out to go fishing unless they could be gathered together with enough people to make a defense while they were fishing. The Barbary pirates would take Christian slaves by the thousands, and no one was organized to put an end to it. Well, they stayed that way for a long time. Some of you who know some U.S. history know that if we fast forward 400 years, the United States is fighting the Barbary pirates. Any Marines in here? Any former Marines? But you know the Marine Corps hymn, right? From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. What's that doing in there, the shores of Tripoli? Because one of the first military engagements that our Marines fought back at the beginning of the 1800s under the presidency of President Thomas Jefferson, started under Adams and then under Jefferson, was we fought the Barbary Pirates. They demanded from American from the United States of America tribute so they would leave us alone. And we were like, we're not paying tribute to anybody. And so we went and we fought them and we beat them in the first Barbary War. So the Barbary Pirates were there and they were a menace for a long time. But getting back to our story. So the Barbary Pirates were a problem, and this is the big picture. During all of this time, Europe is beginning to discover the world. Europe goes through the Renaissance, and they say, oh, we're learning about science. We want to go and find out places. We want to trade during the Crusades. We had learned how we could get a bunch of really good stuff from India and China during the Crusades, and the Europeans wanted all that stuff. And to get there was a problem. To get out here to the Far East, we had to go through the East and the Middle East. That's why it's called the Middle East. So I had to get way out here. You have to pass through all of this territory, all controlled by Muslims, who would take every opportunity to collect any trader. These were people who were not intent on war. You passed through Muslim territory and they got you without paying a tribute, or even if you did, they got you and you became a slave. So Europeans were looking at this and they were saying, how in the heck are we going to get over there to the Far East? I don't know. It's dangerous. And so they were looking for lots of different ways. One guy had an idea. Christopher Columbus. This is all going to come back to Lepanto, I promise you. All right. So one guy had an idea, Christopher Columbus. Part of his motivation was the same motivation that lots of European merchants had, which was, how can I get to the Far East without having to pass around the Muslim pirates? And he said, well, let me sail west. Now, of course, there's the idea of going around Africa, and the Portuguese were working on this. There was actually an issue because they didn't have the right sails. The Portuguese had to invent a new kind of sail in order to do this. But what's the problem with making this trip? That's wrong. And then once you get around the side over here, you still have the pirates to deal with. You've got storms to worry about. Not good. You can cut all the way across this northern section through the deserts and the mountains. That's not good either. So Columbus said, if I just sail this way, right, I'm going to come out on this side of the world because it's round. He knew the world was round. All educated people have been knowing since the ancient Greeks that the world was round. But Columbus thought the world was round like in baseball, when in fact the world's round like a softball. Okay. Right? It's bigger. Yeah. He was missing. Yeah. He was missing all of the Americas. So he thought he could just cross a little gap and he would get to the far east. He was wrong and he discovered the Americas, right? So, but that's how we get what we got today. Columbus Day. This is where we are. So, getting back to our story. In 1453, the Turks are now being led by a new leader, and they're no longer the Seljuk Turks, they're the Ottoman Turks. And they conquer, finally, they conquer Constantinople, and they defeat the Byzantine Empire. So now we're really getting into the heart of our story about Lepanto. So we see where everything has come from, how Muslim empires have risen, the Turks have come and taken over, and they're spreading and they're controlling an area that was once Christian. That was once Christian. And Suleiman the Magnificent unleashes a series of attacks. So when Suleiman takes over, Suleiman really controls this area that you see in the red. And then as you read the map, as the color changes, that's more territory he's adding every time. Suleiman is unbelievable, one of the great leaders of the world in terms of running an empire. He's got it going on. And the Ottoman Empire is at one of the heights of it's ever going to be. And he's really taking control at the cost of Christian nations. In fact, half of the Mediterranean is basically his pond. And there's nothing you can do about it. If you want to travel through that part of the Mediterranean, you better be willing to find some kind of a way to pay off Suleiman or suffer the consequences. And so, what the Christians find themselves under is a reduced area that they can really navigate in.
But what's going on right here? The Barbary Pirates. And guess who's paying the Barbary Pirates at this point? Suleiman.
In fact, he's taken the leaders of the Barbary Pirates, a guy named Barbarossa, and he's basically made Barbarossa his admiral for the Western Mediterranean. And he says, go do whatever you want to do. That guy Barbarossa was unbelievable. He struck fear. The name Barbarossa just struck fear. And somebody said, Barbarossa's coming. People ran. He lived on the coast. So,
but the ultimate goal was what Suleiman called the big red apple, Rome. And what he wanted, what Suleiman wanted more than anything, was to do to Rome what he did to Constantinople. And that is to take St. Peter's Basilica, like he had done with the Hagia Sophia, one of the most beautiful Christian churches in the world, and converted the Hagia Sophia into a mosque. He wanted to take Rome and convert St. Peter's into a mosque. There would be minarets and muezzins calling people out to prayer five times a day, if he could. If he could. But the key lies right here in this area. So Suleiman knows he's got to take care of the center where that boundary line is. Meanwhile, while the Muslims are consolidating themselves behind one powerful ruler, Christianity keeps fragmenting. We lost half of the body in the Great Schism. And then we get to the 1500s, and Martin Luther calls into question certain teachings of the church, launching the Protestant Reformation. So just as the Muslim world is becoming consolidated, the Christian world is fracturing again. In fact, we talked about this already. In France, every one of these little yellow dots that you can see is a little dot that indicates these little enclaves of Protestants within Catholic France. And there are wars going on as those Protestant Huguenots fight against the Catholic crown, who really wasn't that great a Catholic to begin with. He chose Catholicism because that was the only way he's going to get to be king. And he famously said that Paris is worth a mass. In other words, I got to go to mass to get Paris? Okay, well, Paris is worth a mass. I'll be Catholic. So that's sort of the idea behind some of the leaders that you have going on. Here, there's no one single Germany. Germany is a whole bunch of different principalities. Lots of little different principalities. And every prince began to select Protestantism or Catholicism depending on how it would be for them politically, depending on how it would be for them financially, depending on whether or not if my enemy is one religion, I'm choosing the other. This is what was happening in Northern Europe. In England, England had a man on the throne that the Pope gave him the title Defender of the Pope gave the title Defender of the Faith to Henry VIII. And then Henry VIII decides that he's going to break away from the Catholic Church and sets England on a Protestant course. By the way, the King of England and the Queen still keep the title Defender of the Faith that they received from the Pope. But you can't be Catholic and be monarch of England. Why don't they give the title up since they got it from the Pope? I don't know. But anyway, so this is what's going on. So what are we left with? We're left with some Italian city-states, and we're left with Spain, and we're left with here the Holy Roman Empire under the Holy Roman Emperor, who are Catholic, especially Spain, though. We have to say that Spain's King Philip II really was a staunch defender of Catholicism. He just didn't always make the best decisions sometimes. So, you've got France that's mostly a Catholic nation fighting internally. But not only was France fighting internally, France was fighting Spain, two Catholic countries. Because this area and Spain were teamed up to fight against France. So you got Catholic leaders, fighting Protestant leaders who are fighting Catholic leaders, and everything is falling apart at the same time that the Ottoman Empire is on the move. This is what France even did.
France not only was fighting against Catholic Spain, but in order to hurt Catholic Spain, the King of France told the Barbary pirates that they could use Toulon as one of their ports.
They welcomed the Barbary pirates into the ports of Toulon. And the oars, because at this time, the great, great big ships that they fought with all had oars. And chained, teams of people chained to benches rowing. The oars that were on the ships at the Battle of Lepanto for the Ottomans came from France. So this is the condition that Europe was in at that time. The Italian city-states were no better. The Italian city-states, there was no one single Italy. Italy was a bunch of cities that controlled territory around them, and they were all jealous of each other, and they all fought with each other over trading rights and over territory. In particular, Venice was one of the greediest of them all, one of the best traders that ever existed. They were phenomenal traders, but they protected their trading rights more than they protected their faith. That was more important to them in Venice. So here we see Venice, and Venice owns all of these lands here, including Rhodes, which is about to come into our story in a little while, and they're trading with the Ottoman Empire. And they are willing to do anything not to go to war, because war at sea meant that ships that would have been carrying goods are going to get turned into warships. And in a war, you might lose your warship. And they didn't want to lose their warships because then they couldn't carry goods on them anymore. Meanwhile, Rhodes, here we come. Suleiman is going to attack Rhodes. This is where those knights that we talked about in the crusade, those crusading knights that kept the crusading spirit, at this point, there's no more Knights Templar. They've been suppressed. So the Knights of the Hospitaller of St. John, they're the main knights out there, and they're kicking butt. They're on Rhodes, and they are doing everything they can to disrupt the Turkish fleets. And it's getting to be a thorn in the side of Suleiman. He's got to get rid of them. Plus, look how close they are to the empire. So Suleiman says, look, finally I can't deal with these guys anymore. I got to go after them. And he sends and captures Rhodes from the Knights Hospitaller. He says, I will let you go after a long siege. And one of the people that he lets go is a guy named Jean de Valier. He's going to come back into our story. So one guy who gets away to remember this is a guy named Jean de Valier. And the knights now are looking for a place to go live. They're not on roads anymore. So they're looking around and they say, hey, can I have a place to live from this French king and this Spanish king? And finally the Spanish king says, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will give to you a tiny rock. I mean, really, a rock in the middle of the Mediterranean. Y'all can have that. This rock has no natural springs on it. It's nothing but rock. But there were some people living there, the Maltese. And so the king of Spain, Charles, at the time, said, you can have that rock, put you a fort there, and go and fight the Ottomans. You got it. I'm asking for one thing in return. You got to pay me every year rent. Does anybody know what the rent was? It's the title of a famous Humphrey Bogart movie. A Maltese Falcon. That was the rent that the Knights of Malta now had to pay in order to get that island. And they were willing to do it. Falconing was one of the great sports of the Middle Ages and even into pre-modern times. And so Maltese falcons were especially prized. So he said, you got to give me a Maltese falcon. So from this little rock right here, now I need you all to keep your mind on this. They are going to harass everything that passes this way. Remember, the Ottomans want to get here. To get here, they can't pass right here. Because the gap between Sicily and the boot of Italy is like that small. So in order to get up to Rome, they're going to have to pass around. But to pass around means they have to pass around Malta, which is now being defended by some of the most fearsome Christian knights that there are, people who are great at their jobs. So now Suleiman's got a problem. He's got to take care of Malta before he can get to Rome. So, they were disrupting Ottoman trade, and in particular, the ladies in his court would do a little bit of speculation. They would buy a bunch of glass from Venice, and they would wait, and they bought so much glass that what would happen is they were hoarding the glass until the price would, because supply and demand, what happens when there's not a lot of something on the market? The price jacks up, right? So they were speculating. And so they would buy a bunch of glass items, for example, from Venice, and they would hold on to it, and they would make a bunch of money once the price had gone up. But those Maltese knights, the Knights of Malta, were then just ripping them off, knocking their ships out of the water, capturing their ships, sinking their ships. And so the women in the court of Suleiman, they were really the ones saying, you got to go get Malta. We're losing money. So Suleiman says, let's go. And he says there are other reasons too. If I get Malta, I can establish control on both sides of the Mediterranean. It'll give me a base of operations from which I can begin to attack Sicily. And then finally, Rome, the big red apple. So against all odds, he attacks Malta. He lands with over 100,000 troops. And the knights have less than 1,000 knights. Now they've got some Maltese who live there who are going to defend their island, and they've got some others, but there are less than 1,000 knights defending Malta. And against all odds, they hold on to Malta. Defending Malta was Jean de Valier, the guy who had been on Rhodes, who remembered the siege of Rhodes. And he remembered what happened at Rhodes, and he said, will not happen under my watch. We're not giving up Malta. And under his defense, Malta stood. Interestingly, the day that the Ottoman Turks decided that they were going to leave happened to be September 8th, which happened to be the feast of the Nativity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, which, as we know with Lepanto, she's going to figure into the story of Lepanto as well. Was she present helping out at Malta in a way that we're not aware of? Considering that it happened on her feast day, maybe so. They actually left the island on September 11th, 1565. Interesting date that one of their greatest defeats comes on a day that they chose to attack the United States. For Muslims, dates are very important. They don't pick them just because, but they have specific dates in mind. And there's some reason to believe that this date of the defeat at Malta, when they lost at Malta, did go into some consideration for 9/11. It was no coincidence. As many as 30,000 Turks are killed. Now, enter Pope Pius V. He was born to a humble shepherd. Unlike the previous popes during the Renaissance, who came from all the wealthy families and who lived not like we think popes should live, but who live like princes and kings. There was a rough period for papal leadership during the 14 and 1500s. Under some of the Medicis, who controlled papal intrigues, and some of the other families. But, whereas people had said about the popes back then, those guys in Rome are living it up and having a good life. Why can't I do that? The popes were setting a bad example. This guy gets in power, and it's the exact opposite. His life of piety and austerity begins to influence the people around him in a positive way. He comes from the Dominicans, an order that is devoted to the rosary, so we should not see any surprise that the Blessed Virgin use someone in the papacy who had a devotion to the rosary to help spread it. He did so many great things for the church, it's hard to count them all. For example, the Council of Trent said, we got to deal with Protestantism. The Council of Trent issued a bunch of things that needed to happen. He made sure they got done. He reformed the seminaries so that priests were trained and they knew how to get out. He and St. Charles Borromeo did that. He revised the liturgy of the Mass,
There was a point where you would go from one end of Christendom to the other, and the mass could be said any old kind of way without much uniformity, something that we find hard to believe. But he said it cannot be anymore. It must stop. And he instituted the mass that some of you might remember from when you were children, the mass pre-1965. The mass before Second Vatican Council was the mass that he had reformed, that served the church for 400 years. That was under his watch. And most importantly, he recognized the threat of Islam, and he recognized that he was the one figure in Europe who could possibly organize forces to counter it. And so he made fighting Islam one of the keys to his papacy. Meanwhile, there's a change in leadership in the Ottoman Empire as well. Suleiman dies. His son, Selim II, becomes sultan. And every new sultan is required to prove his military leadership to consolidate power. Because there were so many intrigues going on, just like in Christian courts, to get rid of a leader and put somebody you want in, that the leader was compelled to show a strength of force by conquering one of the infidel nations. And so Selim said, I've got to go conquer somebody to show that I'm sultan. And so he picks Cyprus, which had been hanging on right next to the Ottoman Empire. How come Cyprus had never been conquered before? Cyprus was a Venetian island. And if you remember what I just said about Venice, Venice cared more about trade than they did about the faith. Venice would pay regular tribute to the Ottoman Sultan in order to make sure they controlled Cyprus. But Selim said, I've got to conquer something. Cyprus is right there. I'm going to get it. Plus, it just so happens that he loved to drink. In fact, his nickname was the Sot. And his favorite vintage came from the island of Cyprus. So, as a bonus, I can get all the vineyards. So he attacks Cyprus in 1571. Now remember, Cyprus is controlled by Venice. Selim sends more than 200,000 troops. Venice doesn't send anybody. Think about that. So, there are two main cities on Cyprus, the capital of Nicosia, which pretty much falls right away, but the port city of Famagusta holds out. While this is going on, in 1570, Pope Pius is calling the leaders of Europe to gather them together in a holy league to face off against the Ottoman threat for a decisive battle. And he convinces some of them to come. Spain agrees to come. That's Philip II. He doesn't really want to, but the Pope says, I'll pay for it all. Okay, I'll go. Genoa decides to go. The Papal States, the Pope controlled land at that time, so he had a navy. He says, I'm going to send some. And Venice, at first, says, we're not going to join. Now remember, Venice has got its own island that's being terrorized by the Ottoman Empire, and the people who are being put together are going to go rescue them, and Venice doesn't really want to join. Finally, though, Venice does join in. No Protestant nations joined in. France did not join in. The King of France, Charles IX at this point, was controlled by his mother, Catherine de Medici, and she had other things going on that she wanted to use his power for. And the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian II didn't join in. He had treaties with the Ottoman Empire that he had just concluded a peace with he didn't want to break. So, not a big group against the Ottoman Empire. And it comes down to who's going to lead this. And the guy who's going to lead this, the Pope picks a 24-year-old. Don Juan, not the Lola. Don Juan, or in English we might say Don John of Austria. Don Juan was the illegitimate son of the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor before Maximilian I. It was Maximilian I's illegitimate son. He's the half-brother of the King of Spain, Philip II. When he was born,
They sent him to live with a kind of like a poor family. They didn't want him to know what his background was. And when his daddy dies, Philip is king of Spain, and Philip calls him over, and Philip's like, "Do you know who you are?" And he's like, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, you're my half-brother." And he's like, "Cool." And Philip said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to let you live near the royal palaces. You can't live in the royal palaces because you're only half. And you cannot be called Your Excellency because that's for royalty and you're not." Philip did every opportunity to rub it in the face of Don Juan that he, Don Juan, was illegitimate. But the problem for Philip was that Don Juan had everything you would want in a leader. He had intelligence. He had nerve. He had the ability to analyze and make strategic decisions. He had courage. He had good looks. He had dance moves. What else could you want? He had it all. He's the hero of the Battle of Tunis. He puts down the Moor revolt, the Moriscos, down in southern Spain. And people are talking him up. He's only 24 years old. He's got a pet marmoset, like a little monkey, and he's got a pet lion cub that he keeps at the foot of his bed. He's like the real deal, you know? And so he's very popular, and the Pope says that's who's going to lead this thing. And Philip's like, I don't know. I got another guy. He's really good. And the Pope says, no, I want this guy. So the Pope says, Don Juan is going to be my leader. 24 years old, he's going to command a fleet of over 200 oar galleys. Pretty impressive. Meanwhile, what's happening on Cyprus? Back on Cyprus, the port of Famagusta finally, after almost a year, finally surrenders. They got down to their last horse in the city. There were no dogs, no cats left. May have been a couple of rats. Got down to the last horse. Those were the last to go because the commanders needed their horses to ride around on. So they were the last to go. Killed their last horse. No more meat. And so the guy who's leading Famagusta, Marco Antonio Bragadin, he says, okay, we've done it. We've held out for a year. Venice is not sending anybody. We can keep holding out, but we're all going to die. I'm going to go and I'm going to surrender. Now, the rules of warfare at the time said that if you surrender before the enemy broke the city walls, then the enemy had to grant you safe passage out. So he goes to the leader, Mustafa is the guy's name, and he says, I want to get my men out of here. And the Ottoman leader says, you got it. Y'all can surrender. Y'all can get everybody out. I will even provide the transport ships for you. And so all these Ottoman ships are lined up to take all the people who are out. Meanwhile, 52,000 Turks died trying to get the city of Famagusta. That's a lot. The best and the brightest, people who are hard to replace, died trying to get Famagusta. When it comes on the day of actually doing the final exchange of the keys of the city and all this other stuff, Marco Antonio Bragadin goes to meet the Ottoman leader in his tent. And something happens there. There are disputed accounts of it. But the general line of it is that the Ottoman leader decides he's not going to honor anymore the agreement that they had. Now, one line of reasoning is that he says, y'all killed some Muslim prisoners. Y'all shouldn't have done that. And Bragadin says, I didn't do any of that. I didn't even know those prisoners that you think are here. They left on another ship earlier. They're not here. We didn't kill them. Now, the story that you get from the Venetians, right? This is the Venetian version of the story. The Venetian version is that the Ottoman leader looks at Bragadin's secretary, a young man, sweet-looking young man. And he says, I want your personal secretary to be my plaything. Now, in case this shocks you, this should not, there is a long history in the Muslim world of kidnapping for sex slavery, not only young women, but young boys. And in fact, on the island of Cyprus, when Nicosia fell, 2,000 of the prettiest boys and girls were transported immediately for sex slaves
back in the Ottoman Empire. So, whichever version happens, Bragadin and the Ottoman leader are no longer going to be able to make this exchange, and Bragadin's in the tent with all the Ottoman people around him. He's arrested with everyone else, and his head is put down to be cut off twice, but the Ottoman leader's like, no, 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 I got something better for you. And they cut off his nose, and they cut off his ears, and then they put hot irons to cauterize the wounds so that he doesn't bleed to death. And they take him, and they put on his back some donkey baskets. You know that donkeys wear to carry stuff? And they make him, on his hands and knees, go around Famagusta. And every time he passes in front of the Ottoman leader, he's got to kiss the ground. Then they take him. And they hoist him up, and with their sharpest knives, they flay him while he's still alive. They tear off his skin. He lived until they got down to his waist. And witnesses say he died with the name of Jesus on his lips. Then the Ottoman leader, after he had been flayed completely, cut his body into parts, and sent the body parts as trophies to some of the other Muslim leaders who were waiting on their ships, and took his skin that was still there, stuffed it, and put it at the top of his mast of his ship, and sailed around with the body up there. Wow. Why was this never made into a movie? I don't know. I mean, it's got all the right stuff, right? I don't know. All right, so meanwhile, the Holy League is gearing up. We're finally ready to move. All of this stuff is happening. And this is when word gets back about what happened at Famagusta. And man, the Christians are mad, especially now the Venetians are finally mad. Finally, the Venetians are mad. And the Ottomans come over here where they're going to pull into Lepanto. And the Christians are on their way. They gathered in Sicily. And so now all the Christian forces together, and they're coming this way. And both forces are determined it's going to happen. We're going to have a final standoff. So the Christian forces approach over there. Meanwhile, October 6th, it's a Saturday. Saturday evening, Pope Pius V has rosaries up and down the Italian coast. All of the major churches, rosaries are being said through the night, praying for the success of the battle. Don Juan has on every one of the ships, there are more than 200 ships filled with tens of thousands of men, has every man handed a rosary. And on the decks of the ships, the priests from all the major orders of the church, the Jesuits, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, the Theatines, all of the major orders are saying Mass on the decks of the ship. Confession is heard. The rowers who were down at the bottom rowing, that wasn't a job you wanted. You were probably a prisoner being forced to be a rower if you were in a Christian boat. You were a prisoner. There were some Muslim prisoners of war who were also rowing. If you were in a Muslim boat, you were strictly a slave. Almost all of them Christian slaves. Don Juan takes his Christian rowers and he unlocks them. And he hands them a sword. And he says, we win this battle today, gentlemen. You're free. And there's a council of war for one last time on his ship. Because they're 15 miles from each other. The next day it's going to happen. And Don Juan is hearing from some of the people who are saying, you know, maybe we ought to turn back around. I don't know. And he says, gentlemen, it's no longer time for council. Now is the time for war. So the two sides square off. 206 galleys for the Holy League with the spar cut off. The spar is this part right here. It was cut off. Normally that spar was there because you would ram into the other ship. But the problem with the spar was that it interfered with shooting these cannons. So Don Juan, acting on the advice of an old admiral named Andrea Doria, had all of his spars cut off. And he said that way they could use their cannons more effectively. But, very, very importantly,
The Italians and the Spanish had a new kind of a ship called a galleas that the Ottomans didn't have.
And the galleas was basically a floating gun platform. Wood set up high on the ocean with guns that were mounted. Now, this is the way we think about because we see the movies with guns, cannons are shot all along the way, but that's not how they used to be. It used to be cannons were only in the front. But these new galleases were designed to hold dozens and dozens of cannons in the front and on the sides and in the back. And the Ottomans don't have any of those. Now, they got a disadvantage. They're slow. Okay? The Ottomans have 230 galleys and more than 60 small ships. And October 7th in the morning, the Battle of Lepanto commences. At dawn, the Ottomans decide to leave the safety of their port. And they come out, and it's mist. And the wind is at their back, so their rowers don't have to get tired. And they got the wind pushing them. It's easier for them to turn their ships when they have the wind to their advantage. And at a signal, when the two sight each other, Don Juan unfurls a banner of the crucified Christ that was given to him by Pope Pius V, and every ship raises up a huge crucifix and plants it on the deck. And then the wind shifts 180 degrees. And now the wind is against the Ottomans, like that. And the wind is with the Christians. And the air is in the sail of the Christians. And Don Juan kneels down and prays. Right there on the deck, says a prayer. His commanders follow suit. Here's what the banner looks like. We don't have the banner anymore, but this is a representation of what the banner looked like. Big, huge banner. Now, the Muslims had their own banner. Big, huge green banner with the name of Allah stitched in gold 28,900 times that they were carrying as a personal gift from the Sultan, Selim, on their flagship. So this is really and truly going to be Christ versus Allah. Interestingly also, on board the ship of Gian Andrea Doria, the grandson of the guy who gave the good advice about cutting off the spars, is an image of Our Lady of Guadalupe. When Columbus had discovered the Americas, of course, everything took off that way, and colonies were made, and in Mexico, God bless you, the Spanish had established a colony. And in 1531, a Mexican peasant opened up his tilma to reveal a miraculous image. And the bishop in Mexico had copies made, 5 copies, and the copies were touched to the tilma and then given out as gifts to people back in Spain, including the King of Spain. The King of Spain made a present of one of those copies to Gian Andrea Doria, and he carried the Blessed Virgin Mary into battle on his ship. Not the real one, but one that had been touched. It was on his ship at the Battle of Lepanto. Just as a note, this is one of those ships that have all the cannon everywhere. And this would just make cinematic. I could just see this in a movie. These big ships were sitting out in the front, like about a mile in front of the rest of the Christians. The rest of the Christians are back there, and you Ottomans got to come this way. And they were just kind of sitting there. And the Ottomans didn't know what was going on. So the Ottomans, they start coming toward these ships. And when they get close enough, the ships shoot. Bam! Now, normally, that would be the only shots, because cannons are normally where? In the front. Then the ships turn, and as the Ottomans keep coming, bam, and they turn, bam, and they turn, bam. And by this point, the Ottoman ships were right in the middle of those big galleases, and a third of the galleases were sunk right there. Unbelievable tactics to tow them out during the middle of the night. Don Juan had them towed out in front of his armada, so they would be waiting there. But the Ottoman continue because there are a lot more boats. And then an extraordinary thing happens. Another great cinematic moment.
Normally, the two flagships never got together because the commanders on each flagship needed to hang back and direct the battle. Ali Pasha, who was commanding the Ottomans, sends out his cannon shot as the normally was a blank shot. It wasn't a real shot, it was a blank shot. As a one shot, bam, to ask the other guy, are you ready to start this? And the other guy would normally send back, bam, bam, yes I am, blank shot. But Don Juan sent back real cannonball. In other words, saying, not only am I ready, but I'm ready. And so, the two flagships hurtled toward each other. And they interlocked. And so fighting right there together in an extraordinary move were the two flagships and the two leaders on their two flagships. As the men crossed from one ship to another, if you've watched some of the movies on the boardings, that's how it happened. During the battle, Ali Pasha is killed and his head is cut off. And the little marmoset monkey is seen pulling arrows out of the wood and throwing them overboard. Now, this is one area that was also a disadvantage for the Ottoman. The Ottoman used bow and arrow. The advantage is they're more accurate and you can shoot faster. The Italians and the Spanish had a kind of early rifle called an arquebus, which is really hard to reload, but with one shot, it shot out like grape shot. And the Ottomans did not wear armor. And so the Italians and the Spanish had an armament advantage that the Ottoman Turks did not have. Meanwhile, while this is happening, in Rome, hundreds of miles away, Pope Pius V is in a financial meeting. And he breaks the meeting off and he walks over to the window. And he stares out the window. And when he turns around, he says to the meeting, to the men in the meeting, he says, "Gentlemen, let us set aside our business and fall on our knees in thanksgiving to God, for he has given our fleet a great victory." At the very moment that the two flagships were colliding together, he sees out the window a vision presented to him by the Blessed Virgin Mary. It's a complete Christian victory. Complete. Of the nearly 300 Ottoman ships, only 13 ships remain. Of the more than 200 European ships, Christian ships, only 17 are lost. More than 20,000 Ottoman soldiers are killed, and more than 12,000 Christian slaves are freed. And in Thanksgiving, hope once it takes another day or two for news to come back, but once everything is confirmed that his vision was in fact correct, Pope Pius institutes the Feast of Our Lady of Victory, thanking the Blessed Virgin for her intercession. Just as a side note, I teach at Vilplot High School, as I told you earlier, and I'm often there with the kids after football games, and they will often, after a football game or after practice, end with a prayer, the Our Father, which is great. And then, even at Vilplot High School, you'll get the kids who'll say, one of the kids, one of the leaders, the captain will say, "Our Lady of Victory," and all the kids respond, "Pray for us." Now, we're talking about a bunch of black kids who are not Catholic at Vilplot High School. And I asked one of them, "Do you know who Our Lady of Victory is?" He's like, "No." Just saying it. So I told him who it was, and he was like, "Oh, that's kind of cool," after I told him the story. So, you know, to Jesus through Mary, right? Our Lady of Victory could very well be a key for some of the people we meet. It's not everyone, right? But it's a way for kids to hear, wait a second, the Blessed Virgin Mary might be able to do this. May never have entered those kids' mind before at all. In 1573, Pope Gregory changes the name of the celebration to the Feast of Holy Rosary. And then in 1960, Pope St. John the 23rd changes it to the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary, which is what it is today. A few days ago, on October 7th, we celebrated the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary. All right, I'm only 5 minutes over time. All right, hang on. Heroes of the battle. Here's a painting of the heroes of the Battle of Lepanto. We see Don Juan, or Don Juan, or Don John here.
You got Marc-Antonio Colonna and Sebastian Bernier. We do not have pictures. Barbarigo, who died, which is what this cross means right here. He died in the battle. Gianandrea Doria, that's the guy who had the Ave de Guadalupe thing. And this guy, Alvaro de Bazan, who is called Santa Cruz. His royal title is Santa Cruz. He actually saved the day. Because, once again, Don Juan made a great decision. This guy right here was probably actually the best commander that there was. He wasn't leading the fleet. Don Juan was. Don Juan was. But what Don Juan decided was, I'm going to keep his ships in the back as reserve. I'm not sending my best commander into the battle right away. I want my best commander to hang back so that if things start to fall apart, he can make instantaneous decisions on where to send his ships for reinforcement. And because of that, whenever this guy's things started to fall apart, he was able to send his reinforcements and stop the bleeding on the Christian side. So a great decision by Don Juan once more. What's the significance of the Battle of Lepanto? If the Ottoman Empire had won, there's no doubt the Christian fleet would not have been able to be rebuilt. The great powers who were interested in fighting poured their resources into building these ships. And it's not just with any wood that you can build these ships. You need seasoned wood that's really seaworthy if you're going to build these ships. And so to rebuild the fleet would have taken decades of getting the right wood, enough of the right wood, in order to rebuild the fleet. That would have given the Ottoman Empire plenty of time to do whatever damage it needed in the Mediterranean, unstopped, unchecked. But not only that, if you lose and all of your commanders die in the battle, and all of your second-in-commands, and all of your third-in-commands, and all of your rowers die, well, you can have all the ships you want. Who's going to pilot them? Sicily and the Italian peninsula, which means Rome, would have been open to attack if the Ottoman Empire had won the Battle of Lepanto. Despite rebuilding its navy, because the Ottoman Empire had wealth that was unimaginable, its territory was immense, it could accumulate enough material to rebuild the navy, but the wood was too green, the commanders were too green. And so despite being able to rebuild its navy and scoring one or two minor victories after this, it was pretty much done for the Ottoman Empire in the Mediterranean. And it was a decline overall. Now, the Ottoman Empire is going to hang on until the 1920s to World War I is over. But they'll be called for the 19th century, during the 1800s, they're going to be called the sick man of Europe. Interesting facts. We're almost done with this now. Miguel Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote, he served at the Battle of Lepanto. Some of you may have had to read Don Quixote. Some of you may have wanted to, others might have had to read it. Interestingly, a guy named G.K. Chesterton points out, those of you who are Chesterton fans, I love Chesterton. Chesterton points out that Miguel Cervantes lived one of the greatest adventures you could possibly do, and goes on to write a novel about a guy who just does nothing but imaginary adventures because adventures are not real. I don't know. There was a Christian soldier at one point during the battle, a Christian soldier who the battle was looking bad, and he got despondent, and he went to go and cut down the crucifix on his ship, and when he struck it with his sword, the blade shattered. And then when they tried to reforge the sword, and they pulled it out of the iron, it reshattered again. They didn't try to redo it again. There was a crucifix. You can see this crucifix in Barcelona's cathedral. In the Lepanto Chapel, there's a crucifix. You can see that Christ is that kind of a weird thing. He's like, because there was a cannonball that was shot, and according to eyewitnesses, the corpus, which is normally straight, did this, so the cannonball passed by on the side. That is the end of our talk on the Battle of Lepanto. Do you have any questions? I hope you've learned something. If you liked tonight's lecture, the next time we're going to have is 1 month from now. Father Mitch Guidry is going to talk to us in November, on November 9th, about Christian burial and the dignity of the human body. That's November 9th from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. because he doesn't go over time. So, and the rest of the schedule that's coming up, I do have an announcement to make about those of you that follow You know, I've been trying to get Dr. Bram Petrie, and I want to thank y'all for donating money the last time that we were here to help pay for him. We collected more than $200, which is awesome. However, Dr. Petrie said he can't come.
Aww.
I would give the money back to you, but I don't know who you are who donated it. So we will use it for the Back to Basics lecture series. And what I will do in May is the lecture, I will fill in that date, and I'm going to talk about, the topic will be the differences between the Catholic and the Protestant Bibles. Why do Protestant Bibles have fewer books than the Catholic Bibles? Why do they have less books? Mm-hmm. So that's what the topic is going to be in May. I'm announcing that for the first time right there. All right, anybody got any questions? If not, then y'all are free to go. And be safe on your way back home. If you encounter any Ottomans, pull out your rosary.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's okay. Me?
Yes, ma'am.
What do you want? I mean, what's going on?